Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm Ann Stickney, one of two lore-focused writers from Blizzard Watch, and I've got both of my wonderful co-hosts with me today. First up, let's go the other way around and introduce Joe Perez first. Hey, Joe.
Hey, everybody. You may recognize me from columns such as Know Your Shaman and What Are Shaman Doing with Healing and other things of that nature.
But you also do another podcast, don't you?
I do, and that other podcast is all about lore in games. Go figure.
See?
I am such a story nerd.
You're totally an expert here. Speaking of experts, our other lore-focused writer at Blizzard Watch is also with us today, and that would be Matt Rossi. Hi, Rossi.
Hello, everyone.
How you doing?
Let's not talk about how I'm doing.
It's been a week, hasn't it?
Yes, it's been like a month and then a year, really. It's just time keeps happening and...
things.
As my wife said today, he's like, did you know when we got married that it would be like Torment and Diablo every year? We just up the difficulty. I was like, yeah, can we take it down to Torment 3? I don't feel like I'm getting the legendary drops to handle this level of difficulty.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. All right. So for this episode, I didn't actually have like much of a game plan coming in, but then Blizzard threw me a surprise this week and released a free comic. Which is pretty much, it's one of the lead-in lore pieces for Legion. I hadn't really heard anything about what they were releasing or how much they were releasing. I knew that they were releasing some Illidan animated shorts and, you know, in the same vein as The Burdens of Xiaohao and Lords of War, but those aren't coming until later. We haven't seen any hide nor hair nor hint of their release as of yet. However, I didn't know if they were going to be releasing any short stories or comics or anything. And lo and behold, this week we got one. It's called Bagni, Fault Lines, and it was written by Matt Burns. Artwork by, how do you guys pronounce his name? Is it Ludo?
Ludo Lullaby? I just say Ludo Lullaby. I don't know if that's
Ludo,
right.
Ludo Lullaby? Okay.
It's probably not because it sounds like an Italian name.
I feel really bad because I'm probably mangling the pronunciation. And this guy is one of my favorite artists at Blizzard. He's done a lot of art. He did a lot of work on the original World of Warcraft comic run. He did the art for World of Warcraft Ashbringer, which is one of my favorite shorts. And also Curse of the Worgen, which is another one of my favorite shorts. And then all of the introductory art pieces for the Leaders of Azeroth short story series, those were all him. So
you know,
I mean,
weird,
he's done a lot of work for these guys, and I love his work.
His art has changed so much from the first time I saw him doing the Warcraft comic.
Yeah, but
I already didn't like him when he did the Warcraft comic. Then he did Ashbringer. I was like, okay, I don't know what changed between these two projects, but keep doing that.
Well, it was one of those things where he's done a lot of what they call BD art, which is like mm-hmm. this weird, distorted sort of like exaggerated art form. And mm-hmm. that's really big in Europe and where he's from. So I'm not really terribly surprised because unless you like are into that aesthetic, you tend to hate it.
Well, the thing is that it really, I think it benefits from like looking more painted.
Yes.
Like it looks,
yes,
when he did the Ashbringer, it's more painted looking and it works a lot better.
Yeah.
But his work has been ever since then. Curse of the Worgen is really well done.
I absolutely loved it. And there's something about the way that he draws eyes that I really like. And I don't know what it is, but there's something about every character that he draws. When he draws eyes, I focus on those, and I really like his work. Anyway, so this is a free comic. You can pretty much download it from Blizzard's website. You can download it as a PDF, or you can go to the Madefire website. They've got a motion comic version of it. Motion comic, it's not animated per se in like the style of traditional animation where you sit down and you watch like a YouTube video. What it is each panel has a little bit of motion in it, and there's also a soundtrack that goes along with it. And it's kind of cool, actually. I like how they're doing this. This isn't the first thing that they've done it with. The Overwatch comics that they released prior to Overwatch's release, they also had Madefire versions of all of those too, which was pretty cool. But yeah, it's free. You don't have to pay anything for it. But
I learned this today. Yay.
Enough about that and about the comic itself. Obviously, Magni Fault Lines, this is a lead-in comic for Legion. And we're going to be spoiling the comic, but it's a 10-page comic. So if you haven't read it yet,
stop this. Go
stop
buy
this.
It, read it.
Take 10 minutes, it. 5, 10 minutes. Go download it, read it, come back, and you'll be fine. There's not really what I would call like spoilers for Legion here. It's just lead-up content. But what a bunch of lead-up content. So, Joe, Rossi, take it away.
Joe, you want to go first?
Yeah. So, I mean, this
you
comic
You just
also,
finished reading it, so
I
go
totally
ahead.
Just did. This comic came with onion-cutting ninjas. Like, seriously? So, it's really cool because it opens up with a scene and it's Moira talking to Magni. And Magni's still in crystal form. He's still in the old Iron Forge underneath where he's been for the last 4 years. And we find out that for the last 4 years, she has been coming down here every day to talk to her dad because the priests think that, you know, talking to him may actually wake him up. I think that's kind of cool because it's one of those things where it's along similar lines of what they tell you to do with like coma patients or things like that. And it's like these people are not ready to let go of him. But we also find out that
the thing is, though, I'm going to interject here in the short story. Gosh, which one was that? It was one of the ones at the very tail end of Cataclysm where Thrall confronted Deathwing and Deathwing mm-hmm. showed him the world and everything. There was a brief moment in there where he contacted something that was still alive, like a crystalline statue mm-hmm. thing.
Yep.
And what I'm wondering is, I mean, I'm assuming that they thought that maybe he had passed on, but this was in that short story. That was a clear indicator that this was not the case, that Magni was still alive-ish. In statue form. I don't know. He was in the middle of his Pokemon evolution or whatever you want to call it.
Well, like lore wise, it makes sense, right? They're from the Earthen. They are that line of
they
people,
evolved
so,
from the stone and he
yeah,
just went back to
he
the
just
stone.
Went back to it. He went back to that crystalline form. And that the story you're talking about was wild speculation along all the dwarf forums. And yes, I belong to dwarf forums because dwarves rock. Where it was
literally
that,
okay.
that Magni was still alive and that he was going to come back and that he was going to be like this big whirlwind force and that, you know, it was going to be this huge epic moment. You partially right. Okay. But the cool thing here, and this is what I loved about it, is we see a side of Moira who happens to be one of my favorite NPCs in all of WoW history. We see a side of her that we never really get to see. And it's this touch of emotion where it's like, yeah, you're my dad, but you were never my dad. And yeah, I'm here because I need to keep up appearances, because I need to keep the dwarven people together, because everything we've been going through, if I screw up, if I do something wrong, then, you know, I can't let that fall apart, but it's not for you. It's for me and for, you know, your grandson. So it was one of those cool moments where I'm reading that and then Magni responds. And it was this infinite moment where it was like, you have this little blue text where it's like, he states, I'm like, I can hear her. Like, he can hear everything that's been happening. He can see everything that's been happening.
But is he talking about Moira or is he talking about the other voice?
He's talking about Moira.
Okay.
And that's confirmed later in the comic. So, but I think that's really, really cool. And then at this point, though, too, He mentions that he can hear. Well, I guess this is. I'm sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. You may have hit an interesting point on the head there, because I read that and I took it at face value. He might be actually talking about Azeroth.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he might actually be talking about it, because that ties back in with the end of the comic too.
We got to jump in here because there's something that's been kind of teased throughout Legion that I think ties in here. One of the things you do in Legion is you're looking for various artists.
Hold up.
I think this needs to be talked about.
No, it does. But before
we have to give the spoiler warning.
Yeah, I was going to say we are talking Legion content in this podcast. We're not just talking the comic itself. So if you're avoiding Legion spoilers, maybe come back later.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Anyway, go ahead, Rossi. Sorry.
One of the things we're doing in Legion is we're looking for things to basically their Titan relics, the Pillars of Creation, they're called, and. There's various ones. There's the Hammer of Khazgaroth, the Eye of Amanthul, the Tidestone of Golgoneth, and I forget what the fourth one is.
Tear of Elune.
The Tear of Elune is the one I was going to talk about, the fifth one. Four of them are named after Titans, and one of them is completely slipping my mind, but it's out there.
Well, I mean, we can make the argument that
the fifth one,
love it, but all five of them are named after Titans.
No, that's actually where I'm going with this. The fifth one is the Tear of Elune. And it gets lost. You don't get it in the expansion. What happens is Elune makes another one, which implies that Elune is present. And Elune is a she. Now, the she that Magni is talking about might be his daughter, or it might be someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Joe said it might be Azeroth. If it is Azeroth, it might actually be Elune, because Elune was said to live... in the Well of Eternity.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little further here. Let's actually discuss the comic, and then we'll get into the implications afterwards, because there are several things to talk about on that front. As far as the comic goes, Moira herself, Moira Bronzebeard has been kind of an interesting character, like, since she was first seen back in Vanilla. There was a quest chain where Horde players and Alliance players... had to go into, what is it, Blackrock Depths?
The Alliance players were actually sent by Magni, because Magni is under the impression that his daughter
has been kidnapped.
Yeah, he didn't really know her very well.
Right. And he thinks that she's been kidnapped. And
yeah, she's been captured by dark sorcery.
Right. So, yeah. On the Horde side of things, Thrall sends you there to get her because he figures that this kind of diplomatic gesture will sort of maybe strengthen the bond with the dwarves, because Thrall's still on his diplomacy, I would like to get along with everybody kick at this point in time. So you're sent there, and you're told under no circumstances should you harm or do anything to Moira.
Mm-hmm.
When you get there, Moira's sitting there with Thorissian, yes?
Dagon Thorissian, yeah.
Dagon, anyway. And he doesn't have her captured. He doesn't have her mind controlled. He doesn't have her anything else. She's there because she's in love with him. She's there because she's going to have his baby. She's there because she left Ironforge and decided to go. Like, there was no ulterior motive here or anything else. She fell in love with the guy straight up. And apparently her father couldn't, like, see that or understand that, or, you know, didn't want to think about that. But there's,
well,
like,
considering there was the word. The War of the Three Clans, I mean, it makes it almost, in his mind, impossible, right?
Yeah.
I have to say, though, it's a shame this wasn't, you know, communicated to me before I murdered my way through the entirety of Blackrock Depths, got to the basement, killed my way through a giant fire, the entire room full of jerks with torches, got myself finally into the throne room, killed all the advisors, and then killed him right in front of her. Maybe someone could have pointed out at the door, oh, no, dude, she's totally here on her own.
No, you don't get it. Yeah. She's there because she's, like, really into him. Like,
I gotta admit, I wasn't really paying a lot of attention. Perhaps they were constantly coming up to me and going, hey, no, this is all a misunderstanding.
Well, it's interesting because it plays on the prejudice,
too, right? You
needed
to get those torches from somewhere. Yes.
Someone had to get some torches.
Yeah.
But it plays on the dwarven prejudice, where we believe that the Dark Iron Dwarves are completely lost because they've been serving an elemental lord now. They've been subjugated at this point. They can't possibly be good or possibly have good intentions or be doing anything other than evil. So even if the signs were there, I don't think our characters would have really paid attention.
No. I wouldn't have. But I still think it's kind of funny that I get there and I kill him, and there's this real awkward moment where she's like, I loved him, and it's like, okay.
Yeah, and she's not going back with you. You could tell my father, you can give him the finger for all I care.
Not to interrupt you, Moira, but did he drop the Dreadforge Retaliator?
He did.
Okay, I'll just be taking
and then I'll just get out of your hair.
Sorry about that. Ooh, Iron Foe. Awesome. I mean, that was awful. What happened?
That was terrible.
I'm sorry I murdered your husband.
So
I'm gonna take this artifact with me now. Bye.
So when Cataclysm hit and we got the Shattering, the novel The Shattering, there was a whole section in there about what was going down in Ironforge, because obviously what happened with Magni, when Magni was crystallized, there was nobody there to lead Ironforge. So it left the whole thing open again to, okay, who's going to lead? And all three representatives from all three of the different clans showed up, and there was a lot of fighting going on. But more importantly, Moira came back. Moira came back with her son in tow, little baby boy, and said, I'm a Bronzebeard. This is mine. It's going to belong to my son. So I'm here to take back what's mine. Thanks. And kind of like started playing havoc almost. It was really interesting because there was this whole game thing going on with Anduin where she had Anduin kind of imprisoned, but she didn't say he was imprisoned, but it was really obvious that he was imprisoned. And
you're voluntarily going to stay here for the rest of your life.
Right. And at the very end of it all, Varian showed up and basically sat everybody down in a corner and said, you three, you're going to get along. You're going to lead this thing. That's the end of that. I'm taking my son and going home.
Yeah. She also kind of found out it's not wise to do that to a guy who's lost as much as Varian Wrynn.
No.
He didn't take it well.
No,
he took it like do I have a group of secretive assassin types?
I do.
You guys get together. We're going to go.
Oh, by the way, I'm going to lead you in there since, you know, I know my way through like sewers and everything. So why
not? Varian was dead set and prepared. Varian was dead set and prepared to kill Moira. He was prepared to kill her. But the interesting part was that there were these scenes between Moira and Anduin where they were kind of talking back and forth a little bit. And you got the impression that Moira was not her father's favorite daughter. She was her father's only daughter. She was her father's only child. And she made the dreadful error of not being born a boy, which meant that she couldn't inherit anything, and she couldn't, you know, because she's a girl and she's somehow inferior. And that's kind of how her father treated her entire life. So when Dagrin showed up and started treating her with the kind of respect she thought she deserved, and she did deserve, you know, let's be fair here, she fell in love with the guy and she left because she was like, look, here's somebody who's going to treat me like I'm
like an equal.
Not something that's somehow lesser or inferior or not good enough.
Yeah, his disappointment in her just for an accident of birth was really soured her on him. And that's in this comic, too. That's a big part of the comic.
Yeah, it ties into the comic, though, because, you know, Magni, obviously, he's 4 years. 4 years he's been encased in this crystalline entity form, whatever you want to call it. And he's been listening to her every day.
Basically, he glitched out when he cast Avatar, and now he's stuck that way. Seriously, that is what he is. He is still made of.
It was a really advanced case of loot lag.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
But I thought what's interesting, not just they handled the politics of the situation, but that Magni made zero move to try and take the throne back.
Yes, I thought that was really important.
He was, and that's important too, because that Council of Three Hammers, it had a really shaky start, and there was... which one was it? It was the Wild Hammer one. There was a leader short story with the Wild Hammer.
The Falstad one, yeah.
Yeah, and it was really, 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 really sad. And it's also available for free on Blizzard's website. And if you haven't read it, you should. But it kind of highlighted the tension that was going on in Ironforge directly after the Council of Three Hammers was formed. Because these three clans didn't care for each other very much. Not at all. There's a lot of history to the dwarves. And it took a while for them to learn how to get along, but it seemed like at the end of Mists of Pandaria, when you do that scenario, Blood in the Snow.
Oh, that was so good.
Yeah, that things have finally started to settle down for the dwarves, and they've established this kind of new regime where it's the Council of Three Hammers all over again. And it's working for them. It's actually working out for them. Maybe they don't get along all of the time, but they get along well enough that they're this strong united front. So when Magni wakes up, of course, Moira's first fear and the first fear of everybody in Ironforge is
he going to take his throne back?
Is he going to take his throne back? All of this stuff that we've been working 4 years to put together and finally got, you know, into some sort of semblance of order. Are you going to take that away from all of us? And the answer to that is no.
Well, although it wasn't a fear for everybody, some of the dwarves were like thrilled and thought for sure he'd take his throne back and wanted
The Bronzebeards would. But I thought it was interesting that the statement was coming from Moira, too. Like the whole breakdown of this is the fear of all the people. This is what we have already built. This is the United Nations of dwarves with equal representation for all clans in the ancestral home of Ironforge. Like this is all from her mouth.
Well, of course it is, because Moira isn't there as the Bronzebeard representative.
No, she's...
She's the Dark Iron representative, because she's the regent over the Dark Iron Dwarves for her son, who is now about 5.
Yes, he would have to be, which we haven't seen.
We haven't seen him yet, no. But he's about 5, so at this point, he's a walking, talking, you know, little baby future king of the Dark Irons. And he is the logical representative of both Dark Iron and Bronzebeard, which is fascinating because we were talking about the history of dwarves, and I don't want to like derail us too much, but the dwarves originally, when they originally
this is Lore Watch. You can go off the rails as much as you'd like. Go ahead.
But when the dwarves split, it was actually a three-way split, because originally the original kings of Ironforge were the Anvil Marline, not the Bronzebeards, not the Dark Irons, not the Wildhammers. They're all usurpers. None of them actually deserve the throne, especially Magni. They should all be destroyed. But anyway, I like the Anvilmars. When the Anvilmar king died, and I forget the name of the one that died, he died. His son was considered too weak by the Bronzebeards, and the Bronzebeards started the war. The Bronzebeards were the ones who usurped him and started the war. Dark Irons were like, we're not taking that. We're not taking a Bronzebeard in charge. And when the war fell out, both the Wildhammers and the Dark Irons were driven out. They didn't leave voluntarily. They were driven out. The Wildhammers and the Bronzebeards have had peace since, but it started off a three-way split. When the Dark Irons decided, we're going back and we're taking Ironforge back, the Wildhammers and the Bronzebeards had enough years of peace between them that the Dark Irons decided, if we attack one, the other will come to its aid. We're going to have to split up and attack them both at once. And so the Sorcerer King Thorason at that time sent his wife Mogud to attack Grim Batal, which was the Bronzebeard hold. So in a weird sort of way, they created much of the Bronzebeard Wildhammer good feeling between each other by attacking them both at once. They gave them a common cause.
They were united against a common enemy, pretty much. Yeah.
And as a result of all that, when both invasions failed and the Dark Irons had to go back, and the one at Grim Batal just barely failed. Mogud was kicking butt, and the king of the Wildhammers actually had to go out and kill her himself, man versus sorceress, and in the process, Grim Batal was lost because it was so cursed by her magics. When they chased the Dark Irons back to what was then the city of Thorason, Thorason did some magic, and we ended up with the Blasted Lands, and right at the center of it, we've got Black Rock Mountain. That was basically created by Thorason. He destroyed the entire area, summoning Ragnaros to fight his enemies, not knowing he was summoning Ragnaros. He was just trying to pull through something powerful enough to hold them off.
Like, it's almost like dwarves try to do that and have really negative repercussions when they do.
Dwarves don't really seem to know what they're doing sorcerously a lot of the time.
I found this in a book, and it says it's going to work. No.
But as a result of that, though, what Moira has effectively done through her union with Thorason isn't just... It's like Joe said before, this was considered impossible. No, the Dark Irons were considered accursed. You couldn't possibly bring them back into Dwarven society. What she's done by marrying Thorason, by having a child with him, by being regent to that child, is create stronger bonds between the Bronzebeards and Dark Irons than have ever existed.
Like, literally, the only thing that would make that even stronger is if her son grows up to marry a Wildhammer. And at that point, you have the complete unification of the clans underneath the Ironforge clan yet again under one leader.
Until Thargus kills them all and takes back over. Because Ironvil Mars are awesome. Nah, he won't do that. Thargus is ridiculously loyal to the Bronzebeards. But yeah, the thing Moira has done, the thing she was afraid to see destroyed, is unprecedented in Dwarven history. These clans have not been united since the Anvil Mars. It's been, like, what, 400 years?
Yeah, at least. It might have been longer than that.
At least, yeah.
So this is a big deal. For her to say, you know, this could be the destruction of our dream, she's not kidding. Because the Dark Irons had no hope of ever getting back to Ironforge before her.
And she steps up and says that she's, you know, Ironforge belongs to every clan. We've established that. Mm-hmm. And if I have to, I'm going to fight to make sure it stays that way. Oh, implying that, yeah, she will kick Daddy's butt if she has to.
And speaking of, the War of Three Hammers was 230 years before Warcraft Orcs and Humans.
Okay. So we're talking, the War of the Three Hammers is actually after the Anvil Mars die out, the clan split. So yeah, we're talking hundreds of years, hundreds and hundreds of years. So yeah.
So yeah.
I was gonna say that you hit something interesting. I want to talk about just real quick before we go on. As there's this interesting moment where there's what I call a heartbreak, and it's where Magni says that he has one final request, and then there's nothing until he's like the final scenes. I'm wondering, since and this came up just because we're talking about it, I'm wondering if his request was to see his grandson.
Oh, maybe. And we didn't get to see it.
Right. But I'm wondering if they're saving that because I mean, the last scenes are sort of like par for the course. Like he's not going to leave without being seen off. Right. That's just a thing that's going to happen. That I think that's not something he would request. And I don't think that's something that he would have to request specifically from Moira, because that scene is there's one last thing to do before I leave. But that's it. Like that. And it's her. And he says, I didn't think you would agree to it. So I don't know. I don't know if that's what happened. Because if I was like encased in stone and I knew I had a grandson, and I came out and I was like, wait a minute, I have a grandkid. I want to see him before I go do what I need to go do.
It's really possible.
I'm really curious.
I kind of wish that we had gotten to see that now, because that would have been like, aw, so sweet. But I guess.
Papa, why are you made of stone? Well, you see.
Well.
Why, hello, you remember me from such caves as the one underneath the city, where I've been standing there for 5 years. Anyway, how are you doing?
Gucci, Gucci, goo. Okay, so yeah, basically, Magni has awakened. There's a reason Magni has awakened, and it's because he's been communing with Azeroth, which we had kind of gathered already from that one short story at the end of Cataclysm, that he was talking to the world, as it were, and he has... The world has shown him things. He has had lots of visions while he's under there. And he got a series of visions which tie directly into Legion, of course, because, you know, this is a lead-in comic for Legion. So, Rossi or Joe, either one of you want to talk about the visions there?
Go for it, Rossi.
Oh, Magni's visions? Yeah. That's actually a good point because I'm looking at him right now. He has some of the visions he had of seems to have already taken place. But some of them are definitely new. Like there's the molten fell. He basically talks about a spear of molten fell fire piercing through the heart of the world, which could be the thing we're already seeing. Like if you've looked at any of the previews to Legion, you've seen that the thing shooting out of the temples are Garrus, or it could be something else. But he sees a legion of demons marching forth, consuming everything in its path, leaving behind only dead land, choked with bones and broken dreams. This was what she showed me. This is our future unless we do something to stop it. And the images that they show here are very specifically the Legion.
And it looks like The Sundering Part 2, only this time it's not just like, oh no, the continents. Look, there's flooding going on. This is just the destruction of the world as we know it. And that's pretty much the point of this comic is Magni wakes up. He says, look, I saw some really weird stuff go down and I have some things I got to take care of because I'm not a king anymore. I work. I'm what did he call himself? He said he was a servant for something greater now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that, he said,
right there. I was once a king, but no longer. I have become a servant of something greater. E3 must prepare the dwarves for what's to come.
Yeah. And then he says, basically he's saying, I have no interest in ruling you guys again. You guys have done a great job with what you've been doing, and I'm going to go ahead and take off. But before I do, I need to ask Moira for a favor. And then they go off, they do their favor, and then the last scene just like broke my heart.
This is where those onion cutting ninjas came in.
You want to talk about the onion cutting ninjas, Joe?
So there's this moment where they're talking away from the other dwarves, and it's Magni and Moira, and he tells her, I've watched you all these years. I've watched you grow into a leader, and I couldn't be prouder of what you've become. I have failed you as a father, and I will never forgive myself for that, and I'm not asking you to forgive me. But even if stone can come to life, if three rival clans can live under one roof, then maybe we can be a family again, if you can give me another chance. I don't expect an answer now, but think it over, and I'll be watching you through the stones. And he walks off, and you see this lone tear on Moira's face as she realizes that she got everything she wanted from her dad, essentially, that respect, that being viewed as an equal, as a powerful force, as the rightful heir. Like, she's got all that now. And it only took her dad turning to stone and watching her step up. And let's face it, out of all of the clans, she is the one that stepped up the most to bring all of her people together.
She had to, but like
Rossi said, to defy history, to defy hatreds, to defy prejudices that have been in place for hundreds of years, to quell a war that has been raging for hundreds of years among her own people. And she gets that validation at the end. That was a huge, powerful moment for me, because it's like, it's sort of a cliche redemption story in a lot of ways, but it's something that I felt needed to happen for Moira in particular, after all these years of everything she gave us.
I'd argue against it being a cliche redemption story, because it's nothing. Magni didn't commit a great evil. He committed the sin that many human beings commit. He lost sight of what was truly important. He didn't destroy anything. He didn't, you know what I'm saying?
Like, well, no, I mean it from a redemption story of like,
oh, and
you,
I would argue
the outcast,
you're
have the outcast
you're
kid.
It's Moira's redemption, yeah, and yes. I would argue against that too, because I don't think she needed to be redeemed from anything.
I don't think she did, but if it has those tropes.
I'd argue against that, but I get what you're saying. What I found most interesting about it was that, in a way, Moira has moved. If you want to talk about a redemption story from that angle, she's moved not because she's changed her viewpoints, but she's gotten better at working within the system she's helped create. When she came to Ironforge in the prelude to Cataclysm, she was a blunt force. She hit like a hammer. And if you read the Wildhammer short story, she's being like manipulative and even a little vindictive. But she's now moved to the point where she just, when she's arguing with her uncle, and that's her uncle she's arguing with, that's Muradin, and she straight up argues with him, up front, she isn't playing any political games behind his back. She just looks him in the eye and says, no, if I have to, I'll fight this. And it's not that her position has changed. It's that her means have changed. And that's
she's grown up.
Yeah. You could make it definitely be the case that she's grown up, or you can make it the case that the dwarves have grown up.
Yeah. I think the dwarves as a whole have kind of grown up, because if nothing else, in the last 30 years or so of Azeroth's history, there's been a lot of shifts that had nothing to do with the dwarves, but they affected the dwarves regardless. Just with the world itself being in peril so often and so frequently, and also the new allies that the dwarves made with the alliance and their relation with the alliance and with the other races of the alliance. So there's been a lot of political shifts, and there's been just a lot of almost societal shifts within the dwarven community, as it were. And Moira's kind of ridden that wave and come out on top. She had to figure out how to do it, and we didn't see a lot of that struggle that she had, but it's really evident that struggle was there just because of her placement in society. The fact that she aligned with the Dark Iron Dwarves, this clan that was pretty much hated by both of the other, you know, strong clans that are out there. The fact that she aligned herself with them, allied with them, made herself, well, she kind of accidentally stumbled into the role of their leader because of Dagrin's death. But, you know, she has a child that she's raising, and she came back. She established herself as a strong force, and then gradually she's kind of learned not to bend necessarily, but to work with other people.
Actually, it's kind of funny because it's the opposite of bending.
Yeah.
Because in other cultures, you'd learn to bend and get your weight. She's learned to be direct. She's learned to be a hammer.
Be direct and, yeah.
Dwarves respect that. Dwarves respect you coming at them.
Yeah.
And that's what she's learned to do. She's actually learned how to be a dwarf. It's really fascinating.
And I wouldn't say that like the end of the comic was Moira's redemption or anything like that. I would say that Moira's entire life has been kind of like this, not necessarily redemption arc, but just an arc where she's trying to live up to her potential. And she finally managed to get there. And the end of that comic is it's her receiving acknowledgement for that.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And she hasn't had that kind of acknowledgement from anyone before, especially not her father. And her father's probably the most important person that could have given that to her. So it was really kind of touching in a way.
Absolutely.
So yeah, the comic, it's 10 pages. It's not terribly long or anything, and it's a freebie. So I really recommend that you go read it. But let's move on. Let's move on and talk about She.
Well, yeah, I was actually going to bring that up with in context of the comic too. Actually,
well, Rossi had you already started going down that path, and I wanted to talk about that anyway because there is this obvious connection between Azeroth and Alun where they might possibly be the same person.
You want me to lay like out what I'm thinking?
Yeah, go ahead. Because I mean, it's been out there. You know, rumors about that have been swirling around. I've been kind of working on a tinfoil hat on that, but it's not really a tinfoil hat because the evidence is almost there to justify that opinion. So go ahead.
Basically, if you look at the Titan relics, the Pillars of Creation, like I said, four Titans and then a Loon. And when you go read Chronicle, one of the things that they're talking about pretty constantly is how Azeroth has the potential to have the greatest Titan soul of them all. And when the Titans sent the Titan Forge to fight the old gods, Amon-Thul physically ripped Yashaj out of Azeroth, and in the process created the Well of Eternity. It was basically a big bloody weeping wound in Azeroth that they then had to spend a lot of time trying to stabilize and fix so that the planet didn't die. And they managed it, but you know, the well was there. When the Night Elves started telling legends of Alun, it was after they came to the Well of Eternity, and the thing that they kept saying about their moon goddess was that she rose and fell into the well every night. She came from the well at night, went through the sky, and then went back into the well during the day. Now, that could just be mytho-poetic, but what we know is that Alun is a presence. Alun exists. She can act in the world. She's acted in quests, and she acts in Legion. She directly recreates the Tear of Alun when something happens that I'm not going to tell you. As a result of this, I think even if Alun isn't the Titan soul of Azeroth, which I think she is, she's something that's alive and present right now, and she's tied up in Azeroth because its fate very much relates to the She here. I really do think that there's a relation. I think that Alun is Azeroth's world soul, and I think she's the She here.
I think the comic also, and this is where I was going to tie this in because I was going the same route you were. Mm-hmm. I think that the comic also adds further validation to that point, and it may be a little bit of a stretch, but hey, we're not uncommon with that sort of thing here. I just completed the Tear of Alun quest for the first time on the beta. And I happen to notice that it is a giant crystalline tear. Magni is a giant crystalline creature crafted by Azeroth itself by tapping into that. Like, none of the other old dwarves, none of the other earthen, any of that show crystalline structure. That is a very unique thing. He is the only being of that nature currently. It is entirely possible to me that Elune is Azeroth because of this, and that is her manifestation. Because every Titan has had its own flavor when it created its race. It had its own sort of physical manifestations, its own sort of physical characteristics. Well, if the Tear of Elune is this giant crystalline pillar of creation that she crafted for us when the old one was gone, and Magni happened to be turned to crystal when he tapped into the land itself, the world, because let's not forget, that's what he was doing when he turned into this crystalline creature. And he's been in communion with this thing the entire time, and even states that I can feel it. I am part of it. I am part of this world now. I am one with the world now, where I can feel everything that happens through the stones. I think that you guys were absolutely correct, and I think that Elune is Azeroth. I think that we're just getting further confirmation.
Now you're assuming piece that by I piece. Agree with this Elune is Azeroth theory.
Well, I mean, we'll see.
She's about to
tell you what she's thinking. So.
I have a slightly different perspective on this, and to support it, we just need to go back to the Torin mythos. I think that Azeroth is the Earth Mother. The one that created the Torin, the one that created everything else. I think that Azeroth is the Earth Mother, and then you have Elune and Anshi, who are supposed to be her, you know, her eyes. I don't think that Elune is maybe the world soul itself. I think she might be one aspect of that world soul, maybe. But just judging from what we've seen with Torin history, I can't see Azeroth being anything but the Earth Mother, unless Elune herself is the Earth Mother. But again, you know, Torin legends kind of directly contradict that. So where does that come into play? Is that just legends are wrong, and how does Anshi fit into all of this? Right.
Well, there is also the possibility of something else too. Not to get too into it, but there are other entities we know of that are crystalline and deal with light.
Well, yeah. Elune's a Naru. No, she's not a Naru. She's not a Naru. Yeah, but we do know this. This has been established in Legion. She's not a Naru.
Absolutely, she's not. But I am willing to point out that those guys exist.
Mm-hmm.
And they exist because of... Can we say this? I mean, you should say it, but can we say it? Do you feel like it's too much?
What? Oh, like the spoiler material stuff? You know what? We already said that there were going to be spoilers, so spit it out, Rossi.
Well, I mean, you're the one that told me about it. I haven't gotten to see it yet. Elune is responsible for the Naru.
Yeah, somehow. Yeah. There's a definite correlation between Elune and the Naru. Like, Elune created the Naru. The implication is there. And if that's the case, then Elune might be that thing in between... oh my gosh, when we go back to the whole cosmology, mm-hmm. the chart that was in the beginning of Chronicle, you remember how we had that whole talk about how on the void end of things, there was like the void, and then there was the void gods, and then there was, you know, there was like that step in between,
mm-hmm.
and then there wasn't a correlating step in between on the light end of things. There was just the light and the Naru, and there should have been a step in the middle. But if there was, it wasn't listed there. I think that's where beings like Elune and maybe even Anshi, whoever Anshi is or whatever Anshi is, that's where they sit on that end of the spectrum.
Yeah. For all we know, though, I mean, the Torin myth could be mythopoetical, and both Elune and Anshi could be the same being. But we don't know.
Here's the fun part. If we go into the whole cosmology part of things and we look at that chart, right? Here's the fun part. If that is the case, then that means that Azeroth, the Earth Mother, may be the fullest representation of light in the universe. Like the direct correlation to that void that's leaching out into the cosmos. Azeroth was meant to bloom into this light that's supposed to leach out over the cosmos. Yeah?
That's certainly one possibility, yeah.
Maybe, a possibility.
Maybe. I don't know. There might be something really expansive and huge going on there. I don't think we're going to get quite as huge on the cosmic scale with Legion, but we're approaching that point where we're going to be talking about these really big cosmic things that make us feel so tiny and small. That's coming on the horizon here.
Well, one of the things you've actually got me thinking about just from this conversation... since we're talking about the cosmology and so forth, is if Elune exists as an entity of like in the, you know, above the Naru in the light side of things, it's possible that what we're talking about is the Earth Mother or Azeroth, whatever, channeling it the way that we channel it. Do you know what I mean? Like, we tapped a light as a concept.
Oh, yeah.
And it's possible that you effectively got the world, you know, we have the Emerald Dream as the world's dreams. Mm-hmm. It's the thing, the place where they dream. We could be looking at the prayers of a planet. Like, what does a planet pray to when it needs comfort? You know, that's one of the things prayers are for, is comfort and succor. When you've been wounded like that, a loon might have come to the wound because it's, you know, effectively the creator of everything. It's the light. This is when Velen, I'm getting a little sidetracked here, but when you're doing Warlords Draenor and Velen goes up to the Naru, when at the Dark Star, Kara, and he basically puts his staff on the ground, blasts out into pure light, and redeems Kara at the cost of his own life. You get a letter from Velen after you do that, and it takes you back to Karabor, and there's an altar in Karabor. You go up to it, and Velen's, I don't know, memory or spirit or whatever you want to call it appears and speaks to you and goes, "Savior of my people, I hope you can help them understand. The light is life, and it cannot be destroyed, only changed. I knew when I saw that noble Naru, the reason we were able to escape in the first place, when I saw her darkened and corrupted, I knew what I had to do." So it's, do you see what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
There's that. This might transcend, you know, Ilun might transcend things like Titans and Titan souls and world souls. And it might just be that thing coming in response to the, you know, the cry of pain of something so vast and enormous trying to be born and being so horribly wounded. And then the question becomes, what is Anshi? Well, if Ilun is that, Anshi could be anything. It could be... We have the cosmology, the lights up top, and then the various other spheres are around it. I believe fire is right next to light.
No, it's nature's on one side, mm-hmm. and then fel is on the other.
Okay, fel is on the other. That's interesting.
Yeah, it goes, there's holy, nature, arcane, shadow, where's necromancy.
I don't have the book here.
Fel.
But where's the elemental plane of fire in relation to it? Like, where is it touching?
Yeah, it touches both light and fel.
So there you go. If you have this pure force of light, Anshe could be it's where it touches fire.
I don't know. It's kind of interesting to think about, though, because like I said, a lot of this, you know, when I heard about this, I kind of went back and I looked at those Tauren legends again just to see what they said.
Isn't there one about like how when the Earth Mother created the Tauren, she did so by casting her shadow out onto the land?
I don't think so.
Let me go look that up. You guys keep talking.
Well, no, I'm looking at it right now. She's basically, it says, the creator's loving gaze was so powerful that she closed one dreaming eye for every turning of the sky, thus turning day into night for the first dawning of the world. When the creator spread her arms out across the golden plains, the Shuhalo arose from the soil wherever the arm's shadow had passed. So yes, there is a shadow.
So the shadow, basically the Tauren come into creation wherever, you know, in her shadow, they come out of her
mm-hmm.
from where she blocks the light. That's interesting.
It's, yeah. I mean, all of the Tauren legends are really kind of interesting because they weren't really written down. I mean, yes, you do have the scrolls up on Thunder Bluff, but those were basically people writing down what they remembered, what had been passed on.
Yeah, it's the problem with oral tradition, right?
It's oral tradition, and it's also the fact that the Tauren themselves, they were nomadic, so they were separated into different tribes, and those tribes would just kind of wander the plains, as it were. They didn't necessarily like have any sort of written history or anything. They just had that traditional history that was passed down through telling tales at the campfire. And of course, you know, as with any good game of telephone, those words get kind of shifted over the years. They get kind of like they change, they alter. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
I'm reading the Sorrow of the Earth Mother myth now because I Googled all this stuff and found some guy named Matt Rossi had written about it. So I was like looking at it and I'm starting to get this idea of the Earth Mother transcending even what we're talking about. So it is interesting. I do still think that the loon might tie into it, though, because there's the fact that she's one of the five titans for the Pillars of Creation, that she was involved in the creation of the Pillars of Creation is kind of fascinating.
I feel like I should go on record here because I obviously since, well, I think that was one of the first. It was the first tinfoil hat I ever did. mm-hmm. back at the old website was Iluna Zanaru.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had all of this evidence to support it, like so much evidence to support that theory. One of the most direct ones that still to this day, I look at it and I go, yeah, that. There was an illustration done of Ilune for the, I want to say the Warcraft RPG books.
Mm-hmm.
And it depicts a night elf who's wearing this very crystalline looking crown. And that crystalline crown looks exactly like Naru architecture and like all of the Naru architecture and all of the buildings and all, even the Naru themselves, all of the stuff that we saw in Burning Crusade that was introduced in Burning Crusade looked like that. There was a direct correlation there. And I'm like, there's something going on here.
And that's been established.
Despite saying all these years that Ilune is a Naru, I'm okay with actually where they have her right now as not a Naru, but still connected with them.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause if she created them, that makes all kinds of sense. And it still leaves that kind of sense of mystery of what the heck is she? I guess maybe that's what we're trying to like kind of untangle today. And I don't know if we're going to come up to any kind of solution. But like,
what's interesting too, is it ties into so many things that are weird and crystalline about Titan stuff that we never really figured out. Like, why are there those crystal caves in Un'Goru?
Right.
Why are there other crystals up in Sholazar?
Why are those weird pillars of light? You know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. It all sort of ties together. But I mean, the biggest thing, the only thing really that I can look at here as far as a possible explanation for what Ilune and Anshi are, it's not even really what they are. It's just that cosmology chart, because the light directly, it's directly across from shadow. It corresponds to shadow. So there's light, shadow. There's the shadow like the void, and there's holy.
Mm-hmm.
There's the void lords, and then nothing on the holy side. And then there's the old gods and the Naru. And yeah, I think that Ilune and Anshi hit that they are the opposite of what the void lords are.
There might even be more than just the two of them.
There might be some for every planet. We don't know.
Yeah. What's really interesting too is the idea that the Naru, in a way, are the light version of the old gods, and how the old gods are these creatures of corruption, but they're housed in flesh, even though they're created by.
That's why I'm still wondering. I had a tinfoil hat out there, and I'm still wondering if this is the case. If the old gods are basically the Naru as afflicted by the curse of flesh.
That's one interesting way to look at it.
It's like a shadow Naru that's been inflicted with the curse of flesh. So it's just kind of like devolved into this thing. And I think that that's been disproven, but at the same time, it's still an interesting theory. I don't know. Joe, you've been quiet. I need you to say something.
Well, no, I've just been kind of thinking, because like there's so many different, and we, you know what, this brings me back to when we first started talking about Chronicle. We even said this. Chronicle is going to give us this big definition of like history and what happened, but it's not going to stop the theories of what else is going on, because while it gives us a base, there's still so much possibility. And right now I'm just trying to pick my way through it mentally. Like I'm still trying to figure out where everything slots in. I don't really have a whole lot more to say about that right now. But like, it's fascinating that despite how much we know, despite how much has been proven or disproven or given credence, we still don't know everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's still so much has yet to be defined. There's still so much, even in the game's lore, even looking at Chronicle, that I don't know, almost seems to contradict itself in such a manner where like you could see perspective, but like trying to pick those apart to get to the root of the truth or what connects them is so boggling.
One thing I do want to say is that whatever is going on here, whoever the she is, she's talking to Magni, and Magni leaves to do her will, and he's going out into the world like Kane from Kung Fu to basically try and get everyone on board on the Legion thing. And that's all we know. We don't know where he's going exactly or what he's going to do when he gets there. But he's a big crystal dwarf and he's out there to fight demons, I guess.
Well, and I'm really fascinated by the fact that he's still attuned to the world, right?
He's still like crystalline. He didn't change. He didn't change back. It's like he just started moving again. It's like
it's such a broad thing though, right? Because
I mean,
look at all the other Titan Watchers. Look at all the avatars of the Titans that were created and put onto Azeroth. I don't think we've heard any of them have that sort of claim to be absolutely in tune with the entirety of the planet, right?
No,
I don't think so. No.
So this is the first time we've
outside the planet. Really, they don't.
They are, which is, that's why I'm kind of like I'm with you as far as like, if Elune is in Broiled and Azeroth, there's a deeper connection than we possibly understand. But it's like, now we have to know, I need to know what Magni is serving. If it is Azeroth, if it is, you know, a Naru that's embedded in the planet somehow, or if it is a something else that's bridging the two together.
Or just the Earth Mother.
Or just the Earth Mother. But who's the Earth Mother? Like, that's, yeah, and that's the thing. Like, who is, that leads that next question. Who's the Earth Mother? Is the Earth Mother, you know, a split personality and that, you know, presents herself as Elune and Anshi? Is it the being of Azeroth that's still yet to hatch? Is it the spiritual manifestation of the physical form of Azeroth that's still trying to piece itself together? Because we don't know. And that's the other thing we don't know, is we know that Azeroth was wounded, and we know that that wound is still there, kind of.
Yeah, because it was wounded, then they tried to stabilize it, and then we blew up Kalimdor.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's not good for a wound to have it explode.
Right. So, but we don't know what that caused. We don't know what that fractured, and we know so little about how Titans are born, how they are sort of in that gestation period, what happens to them and how they identify and how they grow, that these could all be just different pieces of the same Titan. Like, these could all be different pieces coming together for it too. It's fascinating.
Like, where you have the Emerald Dreams. Well, the Emerald Dream is like the manifestation of its dreams. And then maybe Elune is the manifestation of something else. I don't know.
Like maybe Elune's a manifestation of its hope, because let's be honest, like, there's always that hope and peace and sort of joy that's associated with Elune, right?
I'm still leaning towards that whole cosmology chart and the hole in it, like the gap in it, in that one particular spot. Everything else lines up perfectly, and there's just that one missing piece there.
That's the thing I was like touching into about we talk about the Naru. The Naru can only exist in our world at the cost of a cycle that gives power to shadow as much as it does light. They can only exist as beings of pure balance. They touch the void, they touch the light. They live in both, they go through cycles. And it feels like void beings cheat, whereas light beings play the game. Do you know what I'm saying? And it feels like if you've got...
Expand on that.
Well, if you've got Elune and Anshi as two sides, like, they're the moon and the sun, day and night, they exist in cycle. One rules at this period, one rules at that period. The Naru are creations that accept that you can't have light without shadow. Light makes shadows. The Earth Mother raises her arms and blocks the light, and then there are shadows. And the shadows create life. You can't have life without death. You can't have light without darkness. You can't create without destroying. The void doesn't want creation to happen. The void wants everything to just be void. It wants nothingness. It wants no variations. It wants no distinctions. It doesn't want to have light and shadow. It wants nothing. Not shadow. Shadow isn't nothing. The void gods live there because it's the last remnant of what nothingness is. But there's all this stuff that isn't nothing. And that's what the Naru represent. They represent the cycle that the void gods are trying to overthrow. The void gods want to destroy that. Did you see what I'm saying? I feel like there's this big piece around that cycle that would explain to us what Elune and Anshe and others like them might be. Because they represent the game, the existence, the creation and destruction and moving forward. The void gods are only entropy.
Yeah, what are they? That's probably going to be the next big question that we're going to be chewing over for the next good however long. Mm-hmm. Because Chronicle covered that in its volume already, but it still left a bunch of holes and gaps. And future volumes of Chronicle are just going to go into the future of Azeroth's history. They're not necessarily going to touch on the Titans anymore because... Well, they did that already. Been there, done that, they're gone, supposedly. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
It feels, again, like you've got one side is playing the game and the other side wants to knock over the board. And that's why you've got Sargeras is a little crazy because he comes from the side that wants to play the game, but he sees the other side cheating and he's like, they're cheating! We got to do is burn the board to the ground and then they can't cheat anymore. Well, true, but that destroys the game, man.
Well, maybe they just need to be a little bit more like Moira and learn to adapt.
By destroying the game, though, then doesn't he then serve their purpose that he's actually... Oh, man.
I don't know.
Because then he serves that purpose if they're fighting against to overthrow the game and he's destroying the board.
Which may be why the old gods aren't. Yeah, the old gods aren't really like trying to stop him so much. No. Are they working with him? No, but they aren't.
They are not concerned about him.
Well, they're not concerned.
Look at the Nathrezim. The Nathrezim love void energies.
Yeah.
They could be a fifth column inside the Legion secretly working for the old gods this whole time.
Because
they love void energies. They love that when a planet gets destroyed by the void, the Nathrezim flock to it.
Well, all this talk is fascinating. And I think that we've kind of actually run out of time this time around. But if anybody has any questions or anything, you can please feel free to email us at podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Be sure to put Lore Watch in the subject line and we will take a look at those and see if we can find any more topics to talk about or just, you know, answer your questions if you've got them. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. And your continued support means that this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your questions answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And for you guys, the listeners of Blizzard Watch and Lore Watch and all of our podcasts, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. They do have several Blizzard titles. While The Shattering is not one of those books that's been released on audio, which I find kind of odd, you would think that they would have done that one, but all right then. You could still pick up the lead-in novel to Legion, and that would be Illidan. It takes place simultaneously, I guess, with Burning Crusade for the most part, but it's a definite lead-in to the next expansion, and it's something that you might want to listen along to while you're checking out the new comic. You can go ahead and download that or any of Blizzard's other titles that are available there by signing up at blizzardwatch.com/audible. And I think that kind of wraps us up for today. So I guess final thoughts, Rossi.
I think it's interesting that we've got Magni now. He's back, but he's not king anymore. And I want to see what he does. Like, what's his purpose?
Okay. Joe, final thoughts.
Same thing. I'm actually very happy that they brought Magni back. I'm really happy that they didn't just let him take back over and completely undo everything that's been so awesome about the dwarves as a whole over the last several years, because let's face it, the dwarf story has been better than it's been ever. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens next and what his role is, because even though we've seen a lot, we haven't seen everything yet.
My final thought, I dig Moira. I've always kind of dug Moira. I like her even better now. I like the fact that she got a little bit of a highlight in all of this. And I like the fact that they're still allowing her to continue to lead, because she's real good at it. And she's proven that she's real good at it. So I'm kind of hoping that we see more from her in the future. And I also hope that we see more of these free comics like leading up to Legion too, because there are plenty of things that I would like to see addressed. You know what I would really like to see addressed, you guys? What happened to Kul Tira?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, please.
Can we have a comic of that?
Is he back or yet?
Like, yeah, in Legion he is, but there's no explanation for what happened. So I'd like to see a comic of that, please.
It's like he was in an episode of Lost for like this entire time or something. I have no clue.
And then he just kind of popped back. I would like to see an explanation for what happened to him. I would like to see an explanation for what happened to Neptulon. That would be fun. There's a few different loose ends from Cataclysm through Mists of Pandaria that I would like to see tied up in comic form, and that would lead directly into that whole Legion thing. So hopefully we'll see that. Anyway, that wraps us up, and we will go ahead and see you guys in 2 weeks.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.